Yeah, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to talk about computing Feynman integrals. And basically, my talk will be divided into four sections. First, I will recall some general techniques, which probably many of you already know. Then, in the second part, I will present some iterated structures, which will be either nested sums or iterated integrals, and discuss these in some detail. In the third part, I will specialize these iterated structures to multiple polylogarithms, which are just happen to be a very special part of these things. And finally, if time permits, I will discuss some applications. Now, in the title of the talk, I put the art of computing, which means that we don't have a machinery for doing that, unfortunately. So, but what we would actually would like to get is some systematic approach, saying, here's Feynman integral, and here's the machinery to get the answer out. And basically, what I would like to focus on are systematic techniques, how we can get there. So that would be a little bit the leitmotif of my talk. Now, but before I start, let me first give you some motivation why we actually bother to calculate Feynman integrals. It's not only that we are interested in the mathematical structure, but there's another motivation for it, and that comes from particle physics. We would like to extract information from the experiments, precise information from the experiments. For that, we have to compare the experiments with theoretical predictions. Now, theoretical predictions, the best tool we have at high energies is perturbation theory. So that means the higher you want to go in precision, the more orders in perturbation theory you have to calculate. And in the higher orders of perturbation theory, you naturally encounter loop integrals. So that is the motivation for doing that. And of course, for instance, one thing you can do, the experimentalists can build colliders up to a certain energy range. So up to that energy range, you basically can verify or look for new particles. But through precision calculations, you get a reach a little bit further out, because if there are new particles just beyond the frontier, which experiments can reach, you will not directly produce them. But you can see the effects of these heavy particles in loop corrections. So if you can calculate very precisely, get a handle on heavy particles which are beyond the reach of what experimentalists can do. And that's very helpful and very useful. Now, let me tell you a few words what the state of the art is for loop calculations in particle physics. There are a few calculations, up to three or four loops, for basically quantities which are just a number. So I put here the R ratio, meaning that is the cross section when you take E plus E minus annihilation going to hadrons divided by the corresponding cross section where you just produce a muon pair. So that has been calculated to a very high order. Yesterday, John Gracey told us about the beta function. That also has been calculated to a very high loop number. Another example is the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon, which also has been calculated up. No, it's the total cross section, so everything is integrated out, so it's actually also a number. Now, but what is more also needed for experiments are calculations where you have a dependence on more variables, like Ivan just pointed out. So you would like to have differential distributions of cross sections, saying you would like to be sensitive to angles and so. And here basically the state of the art is that we are trying to calculate the third order corrections for a few selected 2-to-2 and 2-to-3 processes, meaning two particles coming in, that's always the case in collider experiments, and either 2 or 3 go out. So here we are working on the third order, and that year or next year we hope to finish there. And what is pretty much standard now, that you have the second order calculation for processes where you have, let's say, 3 or 4 final state particles, and we try to push it to more, let's say, 4, 6, 7 final state particles. So that gives you a rough sketch of the state of the art, and you already see not so many loops which we can do.
Yeah, so in practical terms, we have a better approximation, better result when you have when you apply all the calculations.
Sure.
So, but the series diverges on the
theory,
right? So
oh,
when do you see the effect of that?
I will be dead before that. No, I mean here we have 3 orders and. No. I mean, a lot of these processes involve QCD, so it's a strong coupling constant usually. Then it's already good. It's not unusual that the first order correction is of the order of 50%. Yeah, like for instance what I told you about the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon. There you basically have agreement of 8 digits. I mean, that's really the golden plated example of precision calculation. No, that's 3 loops or 4 loops. So, now let me start with some technicalities. Here is a very simple one loop integral. Let's take the external momentum to be 0, so it's just given by that expression here. It means you have to integrate over the loop momentum in Minkowski space-time, which has 4 dimensions as we know it, and if you just naively do it, you can rewrite this integral as the integral dx over x from 0 to infinity, just doing some manipulations. And then you see you run into a problem, which is well known, because this integral diverges. It diverges at the upper edge, at infinity, logarithmically, and it also diverges at the lower boundary, also logarithmically. Now, the divergence at the upper boundary, at infinity, yeah. Then it would not diverge. But the point is to illustrate that you have 2 types of divergences. And that was the simplest example I could come up with.
But it is in constant that the intravariate divergences in this type of theory only occur as exceptional momentum.
Right.
But this is zero mass. No, inside the zero mass, if you are off shell, you don't have.
Yeah, but in the end, what enters the cross-section are amplitudes which are on shell. And so you see the infrared divergences in loop amplitudes, and they only cancel in the end due to the Kinoshita-Lee-Naunberg theorem if you combine them with amplitudes which have fewer loops but more external particles. And this cancellation is quite intricate. So basically, what we would like to do, we also would like to isolate the infrared divergences. So, and of course, since 30 years, the technical recipe to regulate these divergences is dimensional regularization, just the simplest tool we can think of. Now, let me tell you about a few tricks. If you have a general loop integral, you will have several propagators. So they are just you have a product of propagators. So a propagator is 1 over something, and to handle these loop integrals, you would like to combine these products into a sum. So there are basically two ways of doing that. One is due to Feynman, the other one is due to Schwinger. And here the A's, they are just numbers occurring to some power. Just think of this mu E equal to 1, then you just have the standard case. And you would like to combine it into a sum, and you can do that using this identity here, which is due to Feynman. An alternative way of doing this is due to Schwinger, which just rewrote a single propagator, basically, as an exponential. And then you do that for everything here in the product. You get the product of the exponential, which you then also can combine into the sum. So basically, in the end, you always end up with an expression like here. That here is basically, if you replace the x by an alpha, it's what is called alpha representation. And basically, the two are basically also equivalent. What you can do here, you can also do here. So there's no preference for preferring the one over the other. Now, we use this Feynman or Schwinger parameterization to get rid of the loop momenta. Basically, let's just... Okay. The first steps in tackling a loop integral is, basically, you do some Feynman parameterization here. Okay, you can also use Schwinger parameterization. Then you basically shift the loop momentum such that the denominator becomes purely quadratic in K. It's just basically saying you complete the square. So you have a quadratic form, you complete the square, and do it in such a way that it's just a half a K squared and no linear term anymore. Then you do a Wick rotation to Euclidean space. Usually we start in Minkowski space. Euclidean space is nicer, so we do that. Then we introduce spherical coordinates in D dimensions, meaning one radial coordinate and D minus one angles. Now, since we here completed the square, the whole function we would like to integrate depends only on K squared, which is rotational invariant. Therefore, the angular integration is trivial. So that can be done. Just gives you the solid angle. And also, it turns out that the radial integration is easily done with Euler's beta function. Basically, you have integrals of that form, ddk, k squared, minus L, where L is something, which you have to integrate. And then you see here the formula on the right-hand side involving gamma functions and this L to some power. Here, I already basically put another k squared to the power a in the numerator. Just put a to c, zeros, and you get the right formula to use. So basically, the message here is that you can exchange the loop integration really over the d dimensions against an integral over Feynman or Schwinger parameters. No, no, you don't have to. I mean, basically, you have, for each loop, you have a d-dimensional integral. And basically, what you here do, you just introduce for each propagator a Feynman parameter. Let's say you have n propagators, you have an n-dimensional Feynman, n minus one-dimensional Feynman integral, which you still have to do. So it's just exchanging one integral for another integral. What I would like to point out here, I put here a k squared to the power a in the numerator. This minus sign is just my convention. Then after I rotate to Euclidean space, all the minus disappear and becomes very nice. So you can just forget the minus signs and you have to choose some convention where you put your minus sign and it's just convention, basically. I could do the same thing without the minor signs here, so that's not so important. But what I would like to point out here is k squared to the power a in the numerator. If you look here on the right hand side, there's a prefactor, gamma of d half plus a divided by d half, gamma of d half, times the rest. Now the rest depends on a always in the combination d over 2 plus a. It's here and it's here. So apart from that trivial prefactor here, the only thing a power of k square in the numerator does is that it's equivalent to an integral where you increase the dimension d by 2.
By a.
By a, 2a, yes. So just putting a k squared here would increase from 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions to 6 minus 2 epsilon dimensions. That is useful to know, because now there comes the next trick. It's, if you calculate amplitudes, you not only have scalar integrals, but you have integrals where you encounter the loop momentum here in the numerator. So what everybody would like to do is to reduce this integral to scalar integrals where you don't have this loop momentum anymore in the numerator and just your standard propagators, 1 over p squared minus m squared. Now, here you know from Lorentz symmetry, if you have a k mu, k nu, times a function which only depends on k squared, it has to be proportional to the symmetric tensor from Lorentz symmetry. And just to compensate the powers of the momentum, you get a k squared here. And since we are in d dimensions, you get a 1 over d here. And you can also play the trick for higher powers of the loop momentum here. And I just told you in the transparency before, the effect of this additional k squared here is just the same as shifting the dimension from d to d plus 2. Now, to get to this polyquadratic k squared here, you have to do some shift in the loop momentum, which introduces Feynman or Schwinger parameters here. So you would also, in order to reach this f of k squared here, you would introduce some Feynman or Schwinger parameters in the numerator. Now, if you remember the formula for the Schwinger parameters, that's particularly simple. Every time you have a power of a Schwinger parameter in the numerator, that is equivalent of raising the original propagator you parametrize with this Schwinger parameter by one power. So the upshot of the whole story is that any tensor integral you can bring down to scalar integrals if you allow that it's not in the original dimension but maybe shifted dimensions, and that your propagators occur not only to unit power, but to higher powers, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So the message is, in order to solve loop integrals, you don't have to worry about these tensor integrals. Just, it's enough basically to consider scalar integrals where your propagators are raised to some power. So here is basically now the most general scalar integral you can think of, has L loops and N propagators. Yeah, you integrate over k. All the q's, it's written here, are linear combinations of the loop momenta and the external momenta. So how this linear combination actually looks like depends which graph you're looking at. So I didn't specify it yet here. But what I would like to say just, okay, you have L loops and propagators, so it's written like that, and this q basically is calculated from the graph. Now, if you introduce Feynman parameters, you can exchange these L loop integrations over Minkowski space here against an N minus one dimensional integration over Feynman parameters. You get some trivial prefactors, just gamma functions. Here, basically, that comes from Feynman parameterization, and then you integrate two functions, U and F, to raise to some power, which is usually, since we are working in dimensional regularization, it's a non-integer power. Now, the U and the F are graph polynomial, meaning that you look at the graph and you can immediately calculate what U and F is. So there are polynomials, homogeneous of degree L for U and of degree L plus 1 for F. Remember, L was the loop number. So this U polynomial is exactly the same polynomial Dirk was talking about this morning. The F basically is a little bit more complicated. Let me just give you a definition how you get to those polynomials. Basically, you look at the graph. And basically, you have a L-loop graph. Then you look in all possible ways how you can cut this graph that it does not have a loop anymore and is still connected. Now, the lines you cut correspond to some Feynman parameters, and that gives you just a monomial in the Feynman parameters, and then you just sum over all monomials corresponding to all the ways you can cut the graph. So that gives you U, which is basically, as Dirk said, just the sum over the spanning trees. Now, to get to the F, it's a little bit more complicated. You basically cut it once more, so that you get a disconnected graph, basically consisting of two trees. Okay, all the lines basically you cut again give you some monomial, but that time it's multiplied by the square of the momenta flowing through the lines you cut. And again, you sum up all these possibilities, you get a function f0, which is just part of this function f, and then if you have masses in your problem, you get a trivial extension. Basically, you have to add your masses, and here again comes your u in. So that's homogeneous of degree r plus 1. Now, here's just an example, basically, for a two-loop non-planar vertex correction, which is this graph here. I labeled the propagators here 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So the function u is just given by this polynomial here, where, for instance, x1, 5 is just the sum of x1 and x5, just the shorthand notation. And if you don't have any masses in the propagators, the function f is just given by that form here. For the F, well, I mean, it's known since 30 years, basically. There's nothing new to it, and I don't have any more insights than it just corresponds. You can read it off from the graph, and you know it. So it's just a polynomial you have to integrate over. So, now... I just recall, here's this formula. Here we are. Yeah.
The gamma function will be defined.
Right. Right. Basically, here you have the functions u and f. The nu is just the sum of the propagators, so that's an integer number. Your l is the number of loops, that's also an integer. And then you have d half. So we do it in dimensional regularization, so d half is just 2 minus epsilon, something like that. So it's a raised to some non-integer power, and that makes it basically tractable. Now, we have these polynomials, and we have to do this nasty Feynman integrals. And so the next thing, which is also quite standard, but not so well known to many people, is basically the inverse of Feynman parametrization, which is the Mellin-Barnes representation. And basically, when we started with, we had a product, and we wanted to convert it into a sum. So that was Feynman or Schwinger parametrization. Now we got rid of this loop momentum integrations. Now we would like to go back and convert a sum into a product. So basically here we have a sum raised to some power. Usually it's a non-integer power, otherwise it would be trivial. So, and from Mellin-Barnes, basically we know we can write it as a complex contour, a complex integral of a contour running from minus infinity to plus infinity, times some gamma functions, times the individual summons raised to some power. And the contour is chosen in such a way that basically all the poles of the gamma function, that for instance focus here on the first one, which has poles at 0, 1, 2, and so on, the positive integers, so they form a sequence growing all the way to plus infinity. So these poles, all of them, have to be to the right of the contour. And here, basically, you get a series of poles in the variable sigma 1, which grow to the left minus infinity. So these have to be all to the left of the contour. And with your contour, you basically just have to find the way through. Of course, that's not the way you evaluate these integrals by just using some funny contour, but you basically use the residue theorem, closing the contour either to the right or to the left, and summing up the appropriate residues of the gamma functions. So, up to now, basically, I didn't say much which was new. Most of it is basically known to people working in the field. So, what do you get if you really look at some non-trivial examples? And now I will flash a horrible formula. That's basically one particular integral. Basically, you have a massive line coming in here, three like particles coming out, and a two-loop integrals with five propagators. And if you just do the things I told you before, you can pick up your residues, and you end up with something which is a double sum here. Okay, here in the first line, some trivial prefactors. You get a double sum here, a bunch of gamma functions, and then you stare at it and think what you have to do next. Right.
And having done that, you say that in
now
this
case,
at least, you can do the result by this contour integration. I mean,
well,
you've still got n integrals to do.
Okay, you introduce one thing you can do, or one can argue, introduce a Mellin-Barnes, you can show it's always possible to do the Feynman integrals.
Yes.
So you exchange your Feynman integrals for Mellin-Barnes integrals.
That's what I'm worried about, right.
Yes. Now, you can close the contour and basically pick up the residues. You can always do that.
Yes.
So you exchange your Mellin-Barnes integrals for multiple sums. Okay. Now, the point is now, can you manipulate the sums? And in certain circumstances, I will show there's a systematic way of doing it. So if I could manipulate all sums which occur here. Oh, sorry. Now x1 and x2 are dimensional variables which just depend on your kinematical. No, they are gone. Basically no integrals anymore. But sums with basically you have gamma functions here. And as arguments of your gamma functions, you have your summation indices. You have some integers, so mu3 is just the power to which the third propagator is braced, and you have your basically small parameter from dimensional regularization. And 2m, basically I parameterized here my dimension d as 2m, where m is an integer, minus 2 epsilon, and epsilon is my small parameter. So that formula is really nasty. So let's see if we find some systematics in it. And we analyzed that for a few cases and found that basically we always see the same types of sums which occur there. So the first thing is just a single sum where you have some ratios of gamma functions in such a way that you have as many gamma functions in the numerator as in the denominator times some x to the power of the summation index. So basically that is just some slight generalization of hypergeometric functions. The next thing is double sums. You have a summation over I and j, where you have the same pattern or the same building block as before, with I, one with j, and one with the sum of I and j.
So in principle, it's nice to know that the sum is a hypergeometric function, nowadays, if you're just really interested in the numbers that come out, why don't you just do the sum on a computer numerically?
Stop. You have to read the last line here. No, stop. You have to read the last line here. So what the A and the B's, which appear here as the argument, say of the form some integer number, small integer number, which is known, 2, 3, 4, 5, minus 5, something like that, plus a constant times epsilon. What you are after is not this expression here, but the expansion of this expression into the small parameter epsilon.
So why don't you just do that for each term in the sum, and then just sum those with the epsilon? Is that not legal?
Sorry. That's what I'm going to tell you, how to expand that thing in epsilon. If you just type it in a Maple and Mathematica, they don't know that. So basically here are the types. Basically just let me draw your attention to the last type C and D, which are a little bit different. I have here binomial coefficient, otherwise it's all the same. Now the systematic approach to go on now is really to expand these sums in a small parameter which occurs in the gamma functions. For that we need some tools, and we found it convenient to introduce a very specific type of nested sum. It's a sum, a k-fold sum, where basically the k-th index is always smaller than the k minus 1 and so on, which goes up to n. So it's a finite sum. X to the power of the first summation index divided by I, as is the first summation index, to the power of some integer. So the m's are all integers. The x are basically complex or real variables. Just typically there will be ratio of kinematical invariance as before. It's a finite sum. And these are the object we are going to manipulate in the following. Now I would like to make some comments why it's useful to introduce them like that. The first thing is that it contains a variety of special subsets. If you take that sum up to infinity, it's nothing else than the definition of multiple polylogarithms. They are just defined like that. If, on the other hand, you just set all the x's equal to 1, so you don't have anything in the numerator, it's something which mathematicians call Euler-Zagier sum. The nice thing about these objects is that they form an algebra, and it's actually a Hopf algebra they form. And the way we introduce them is because they interpolate on the one hand between the Euler-Zagier-sums and the multiple polylogarithms. We will come to that, basically. So, just to remind you what the special cases are again. Basically here, okay, if it runs up to infinity, you have the multiple polylogarithms. If all the axes are equal to 1, you have the Euler-Zagier sums, still finite summation index. And if you have both conditions together, n equals infinity, and all the axes equal to 1, it's basically a multiple theta value, just from the definition. Now, let me come back to your question. How is this related with this hypergeometric functions? It's related in the following way, because in these hypergeometric functions, we have the gamma functions, which we would like to expand in a small parameter. Now, here's the formula for the Taylor expansion of a gamma function. N is some integer plus epsilon. You would like to expand it around N. So you get some prefactors, 1 plus epsilon. That's not too interesting. You get N minus 2, N minus 1 factorial, also not too interesting. And then you get a series of Euler-Zagier sums. Okay? Here you see that the Euler-Zagier sums come in, why we need them. On the other hand, we know, or we know from some calculations, that we expect polylogarithms in the answers. And that's why we were looking for an interpolation between these Euler-Zagier sums and the polylogarithms. I told you that these set sums, they have a nice property that they form an algebra. Basically, whenever you have a product of two of these guys, you can multiply it and basically reduce it to a linear basis. And here, basically, I worked it out for a sum of depth 2 times the sum of depth 3, depth 1. So you get sums of depth 3 here and two sums of depth 2 here. Pictorial, you can draw it also as ladder trees, basically trees without any side branchings. So you have the product of these two things, just labeled the axis here. So these first three guys are exactly that line here, and then you get some additional terms here. And it's basically, in your result, basically, you get all terms which you can obtain by combining these two strings, the x's and the m's, with the x's and the m's here, in such a way that you respect the order of the first one and you respect the order of the second one, and then you get some extra terms where you can just combine these. So that thing, this multiplication law, is something which mathematicians call a quasi-shuffle algebra. It would be a shuffle algebra if you would not have these last two terms here. So it's a slight generalization of a shuffle algebra. And also by this paper of Michael Hoffman, he showed that basically any quasi-shuffle algebra is a Hopf algebra. So we didn't have to work on that. So basically, okay, we had to show that we have this multiplication, but then it came for free, once we knew it's a quasi-shuffle algebra, came for free that we have a co-multiplication, co-unit, and an antipode, just because it fits into this pattern of a quasi-shuffle algebra. Now, here, basically, let me connect a little bit about what Dirk was saying. He was telling you also about Hopf algebras this morning. And what it turns out, that the co-algebra part of the Hopf algebra Dirk has in renormalization and the co-algebra part of these sums here, they're basically more or less the same. So basically, can also be described by rooted trees as a co-algebra. Now, what we have in addition, we have a non-trivial multiplication. This quasi-shuffle product. And then the real work started. We have some additional properties for these objects. And basically, okay, I just told you we have a multiplication. So whenever we see something like that, we can do the multiplication and basically, again, get single set sums out of it. What we can also do, and that's something which we have to show, that we can do some sort of convolutions. So you have a sum from I to n minus 1 here of something which goes with an index I convoluted with something which goes like n minus I. So there's an algorithm which reduces this sum again to set sums just involving the index n. So that's some sort of convolution. Then we can do something which is very similar to a conjugation. Basically, again, a sum, binomial coefficient, minus 1 to the power I, times something which goes with the summation index I. If you just take here the first part up to here, and basically apply the same sum now with respect to this variable again, you would get the original expression back here. So that's why it's called conjugation. If you apply the summation twice, you get your original expression back. So what is more important is that these sums all evaluate also to set sums with the upper summation index n. So those you can also do and reduce to the standard basis. And then you can have the combination of both of them, a binomial coefficient, something which goes with I, something which goes with n minus I, and again you can show, okay, here you have to work quite hard, but you can reduce it again to set sums, just set of n. And basically these four algorithms which I listed up here, they just correspond to the four types I showed here. For the first one, you just need the multiplication. Here, you need the multiplication and the convolution. Here, you need the conjugation. Here, you need the conjugation plus the convolution. So, now, how is it done now? Remember, the problem was expanding something like hypergeometric functions or generalizations of it. Basically, if you have something like that, you would like to expand it in epsilon. So that's your hypergeometric function as a simple example. Okay, first thing you do, just use the functional equation of the gamma functions here in the Pochhammer symbols, basically to synchronize it, that it's always just the summation index n plus epsilon. So that's quite simple. Then, expand the gamma functions with the formula I showed you. So that will involve Euler-Zagier sums. You get Euler-Zagier sums here, you get some here, you get some here. You invert the power series in the denominator, so you bring some in the numerator, and then you use the multiplication of set sums, basically, to convert them to single, a product of two or three to convert them to single set sums. And then you're basically done, because then what you still are left over with is just the definition of a harmonic polylogarithm. So now, basically, I would like to tell you a little bit more about this multiple polylogarithm. So these, again, let me recall you the definitions. It's basically the same as the set sums, except now the summation runs all the way up to infinity. You have special subsets, harmonic polylogarithms, Nielsen polylogarithms, classical polylogarithms, and so on. What is new here now, that you have a second representation which is based on integrals, iterated integrals. What one can show is that this second representation also gives rise to an Hopf algebra. which is different from the first one. So you have two independent Hopf algebras. And what I would also like to point out, that these functions you can actually evaluate numerically without any problems. I will discuss that, how you do that. Of course, I have branch cuts. So let me just give you an overview of the typical subsets you have. The simplest one are just the classical polylogarithms, LI2, LI3, and so on, the whole series. Then, since the beginning of the last century, there are Nielsen generalized polylogarithms, which are denoted by an S with two subscripts N and P, which in our notation are just that here. And then you have the harmonic polar logarithms, which are basically a generalization of those, where instead of the indices 1, you allow an indices M here, but also just one argument. Now, I told you that these polylogarithms have a second representation as iterated integrals. Now let's start with that. Basically, define a function g depending on k variables z and one variable y by that following iterated integral. Basically, dt over t minus some z, and it's always integrated up to the previous integration boundary. So that's a iterated integral, and the first one goes up to y. Now you have k plus 1 variables here. You can show that basically there's a scaling relation. So in fact, this whole object only depends on k variable. So you can basically multiply it, all arguments, by some common factor x, and you get the same function again. So in principle, you could use it to normalize that y to 1. And then one can introduce the following shorthand notation, that you have indices m1 up to mk. This is m, again, being integers, meaning that for each set in this function here, you have just sets which are 0, m minus 1. So basically, you have integrals dt over t before each set. Okay, with this shorthand notation, one can show that the relation between the multiple polar logarithm defined as before by the sums equals these functions g in such a form that you basically here have running arguments. So you just multiply your x up to k or j, and that's basically the form. So basically that means these functions g, they are basically multiple polar logarithms, just in a different notation. Now, if you have this function g, say, fulfill a different algebra, which is, in that case, not a quasi-Schaffler algebra, but just the Schaffler algebra. So it's a little bit simpler. You don't have these quasi-Schaffler terms, but just the Schaffler terms. Here's an example, multiplication of two functions. You can write as a linear combination of individual functions. Right, here should be a comma. I forgot it. Now, let me just remind you where these multiplication laws come from for the two types. For the set sums, basically, it can be visualized in the following way here. You have a product here. You basically have a summation over two variables here, like a square. Then you divide the square into three pieces here, a lower triangle, an upper triangle, and the diagonal, which just corresponds to these terms here. And if you do it iteratively, that's basically how you can prove that you have a quasi-Schaffler algebra. For the g functions, they are not defined by sums, but by integrals, but it's basically the same trick. You integrate over square here up to y in each direction, and you divide it in that time in a lower triangle and upper triangle, and the diagonal for integration has measure 0. So it does not contribute. Gives you a needed explanation why you don't have this quasi-Schaffler term here. So I told you these functions, these multiple polylogarithms, are Hopf algebras. As such, they have an antipode. Now, what does that tell you as information of having that antipode? And here I would like to show it a little bit, that for instance, if you take the integral representation, one trick John Gracie mentioned also yesterday, the physicists like to play with partial integration. So that's very useful and gives you a lot of relations between different things. So by playing partial integration, you basically can show if you have this function g with set 1 to set k, plus or minus, the same thing where the string here is reversed, it basically factorizes in simpler things which have less arguments. That is well known to us physicists just by partial integration. Now, if you have a Hopf algebra, I told you we have one for this function g, you can just work out what the antipode for this g is, and you will see it's just basically minus 1 to the power k with the string reversed in that case. Now, being a Hopf algebra, there's an axiom which the antipode has to fulfill. Basically, it says, take any function g, just apply the coproduct, map the antipode on the first or the second factor, and then multiply it again. Then you get, for any non-trivial element, you get 0. Now, if you work out that equation here, plug in the definition of the antipode, you will recover exactly that identity here. So basically here, for this integral representation, the axiom for the antipode is nothing else than partial integration. Now, knowing that, we can of course go on and do it a little bit more abstractly. We know that partial integration is something useful, and if it's equivalent to the antipode, we can also place a trick for the other Hopf algebra we have for the set sums. There we don't have any integral representation, obviously, but we can just use the algebraic methods and work out again that basically that thing, plus or minus the same thing with the strings reversed, basically decomposes into simpler terms. And that's quite useful to simplify in the end when we did our calculations and results. Basically, that's a very useful relation. Now, in the remaining minutes, I would like to tell you a little bit about numerical evaluations, because in the end, we get these functions, and of course you can say, well, you just labeled your unknown functions a little bit differently. Actually, that's not true, because those functions are quite well understood, and what matters for us most, we can evaluate them numerically, put in the arguments and get a number out. And the way you do it, basically here, I just sketch how you do it for the d logarithms, which is defined either as a sum like that or in the integral representation like that. You know you have two relations, basically, which relate the dialogue with argument x to 1 minus x, which you can use to map any argument which lies outside the unit circle into the unit circle. Modulo simpler terms. Here's the logarithms. They are just considered to be simpler, so you already know how to evaluate those. In addition, basically, you can use that relation, basically. Once it's inside the unit circle, you can map anything which has a real part bigger than 1/2 to the region where the real part is smaller than 1/2. If you have done that, you could, in principle, use just the sum representation here and evaluate it as a power series. For practical things, that's not yet efficient enough. So what you do, you use some acceleration techniques. Instead of writing it as a power series in x, you write it in a power series and as log 1 minus x times some Bernoulli numbers, and you can show that for this case, it converges much faster. So that's basically known since 79 from Tuft and Waldmann. And basically, more or less, you can place the same tricks for these multiple polylogarithms. You first use the integral representation to map your function whenever the sets are basically outside the region of convergence into the region of convergence. Then you use the sum representation to get a power series which you can evaluate, which may or may not yet converge fast or not. But then you use some acceleration techniques to make it converge very fast. And again, basically all the cuts are taken care of. You see, you have a cut whenever your integration variable basically exceeds the set, which are on the real axis here. Yeah, so basically just one example which you could do with these techniques here. There was one question which was raised by David Broadhurst for a particular integral. It's a two-loop integral with a two-point functions. That one here. And he was wondering what comes out from that integral. So it depends on p squared, but the dependence on p squared is trivial, so you can factor it out. And after having factored it out, it's just a number. So the question was, what numbers come out there? And basically, with the techniques I just showed you, you can really prove that having this integral and expanding it in epsilon, in any order in epsilon, you just get multiple theta values and nothing else for that particular integral. So, and that is just because you expand hypergeometric functions, and basically the expansion of hypergeometric functions are j plus 1 fj, basically just gives harmonic polylogarithms. If you have some unique argument, you just get multiple theta values. So let me come to the summary, what I wanted to talk today a little bit about. It's basically trying to introduce some systematic methods to tackle loop integrals. I mainly focused here on the iterated sums, because that's the method our group used. I should say all the results were also checked by a different group, which basically just used the other method, used iterated integrals, and these were completely different, but we found the same results, so we are quite confident that nothing went wrong there. Would like to say that these iterated objects, being it sums or integrals, they have quite a rich algebraic structure. So first of all, they are Hopf algebras, but there's a little bit more about it. I told you about this convolution and this conjugation, which we still have to understand the full implications of it. And the last comment, all the loop integrals which I know so far, the solutions of it, they can be written in multiple polylogarithms. And would be happy to know about a counterexample. Thank you.